Great, thank you.
The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Wheelock, Judge Reyes, Judge Klopaki, the Honorable Sarah I. Wheelock presiding.
Morning, everyone, and welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. It is Wednesday, June 8th, 2022, and we have five cases on the calendar today, two of which are scheduled for oral argument. As noted, I am Sarah Wheelock, presiding judge on a panel with judges Peter Reyes and Roger Klopaki. This morning, we are holding our hearings via Zoom.gov. So please allow me to address a few matters before we begin. Oral arguments are recorded by the court. The audio recordings of these arguments are generally available within 24 hours on the Court of Appeals page at the Judicial Branch's website. I want to note that our appellate rules prohibit anyone from making an audio or video recording of an oral argument unless you have received the court's permission at least 24 hours in advance and agreed to comply with the specific conditions established by the Minnesota Supreme Court. With that, Marshall, please call the first case before us.
The first case this morning is A22-0219, Healthcare Service Corporation et al. Respondents versus Albertsons Companies LLC et al. Appellants, SuperValue Inc. Defendant.
Counsel, as you probably know, each of you will have 15 minutes for your principal argument. And counsel for appellant, you will have an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal. There is a clock on one square of your screen. So if you're looking at the screen, it should be in the upper left-hand corner, and that will reset the beginning of each argument. I would ask each of you to please introduce yourself and identify which party you represent at the beginning of your argument so that it is clear for those who are listening who you are representing. Please mute yourself, but leave your video on when you're not making argument. And finally, if anyone has any issues with technology at any point, you can't hear or you're hearing an echo, please let me know. We will pause and we will try and help because we want to make sure that we hear from everyone here today. So with that, counsel for the appellant, please begin when you are ready.
Great, thank you, Your Honor, and good morning. And may it please the court, William Roberts of Ropes and Gray on behalf of appellants Albertsons and Safeway. In this case, we have a trio of Blue Cross affiliated health insurers seeking to hail out-of-state grocery stores and pharmacies into Minnesota to accuse them of fraud. But the appellants are incorporated outside of Minnesota, headquartered outside of Minnesota, have no offices in Minnesota, no retail locations or pharmacies in Minnesota, and none of the allegedly fraudulent customer transactions at issue took place in Minnesota. Instead, respondents' jurisdictional arguments rely exclusively on the single contract that each of the appellants had with Prime Therapeutics, which allegedly processed the pharmacy's reimbursement claims. But respondents do not allege and have not put forth any evidence that Prime actually processed those claims in Minnesota. Rather, respondents only allege that Prime processed the claims and that Prime is, quote, located in Eagan, Minnesota. But the fact that Prime's corporate headquarters are in Eagan says nothing about where the claims were actually processed. And indeed, it's traditionally noticeable that Prime has had offices in other locations other than Eagan, Minnesota during the pendency of the events at issue in this case. For example, in Omaha, Nebraska, or in New Mexico, or Chicago. And where the reimbursement claims at issue were submitted electronically, Prime could have computer servers anywhere that could handle the processing of those claims.
Well, Mr. Roberts, that may be true, but aren't we supposed to take the allegations and view them in the light most favorable to the complaint at this stage of the litigation, including any inferences?
So the allegations at this stage, as an initial matter, are to be taken at face value. However, where we have introduced evidence, and here we have introduced an affidavit and the contracts with Prime at issue, that rebuts the jurisdictional allegations. So for instance,
how does, if I could stop you there, Mr. Roberts, sure. How do those affidavits and documents specifically repute personal jurisdiction. I think that is one of the key issues. I didn't see where it actually refutes the issue of personal jurisdiction. I understand that, you know, the allegations that, you know, no office is there. And so I understand all that. But where does it specifically refute the issue of personal jurisdiction?
So among other things, the affidavit from our vice president of pharmacy services, who is responsible for these relationships, has, you know, testified in his affidavit that he's not aware of any contractual performance by Prime to actually taking place in Minnesota.
But how does that refute it? I understand him saying he's not aware, but that doesn't mean that it doesn't occur here in Minnesota. Not being aware is not the same as saying affirmatively, these transactions do not occur in Minnesota. Those are two different and distinct things. One's a direct refutation of it. The other is like, I don't know where it happens.
Mm-hmm. Well, Your Honor, again, I would submit that in addition to the affidavits, the contracts themselves are entirely silent as to where any contractual performance would take place. And so,
right. I think you have the same issue there. You know, those contracts are silent. They don't say where it's going. So how does that refute the allegation that those transactions actually occurred in Minnesota? There has to be some affirmative statement or some affirmative provision within those contracts that says these transactions are occurring outside of Minnesota. If there was that, then I think you would have a much stronger argument. And now you would be putting the plaintiffs in the district court to, they would have to show that there is actually some transaction that occurred in Minnesota.
Well, Your Honor, but there's no actual allegation that the transactions for claims of reimbursement at issue were processed in Minnesota. So if there were a clear and direct allegation making this point, then perhaps it might be a different case. But that's simply not the case with the complaint here.
That's not the issue, Mr. Roberts. The issue is you are arguing that the contract is proof that there is no personal jurisdiction. But the contract doesn't have any language that would refute the allegation that there is personal jurisdiction in Minnesota.
Well, Your Honor, I think I think your question is conflating two things. One is the question of whether or not there are contacts with Minnesota at all. And then the second would be whether those contacts are sufficient to establish personal jurisdiction. I think, you know, and look, Your Honor, I take your point. And if even if our evidence submitted doesn't directly refute the idea that there are some contacts in Minnesota, I would still submit, and we argue, and I can go to this issue, that those contacts are insufficient to establish personal jurisdiction in Minnesota, even if they exist, which we submit they do not on the basis of the existing record and allegations.
Right. And I don't think I'm conflating the two, counsel. Because I take your point that you take issue whether or not they have made sufficient allegations to establish personal jurisdiction. I'm just assuming for the sake of argument that they do at this point, just for the sake of argument, mm-hmm. and then trying to determine where the affidavit or the contract have enough information to refute that allegation. So I understand where you're coming from. I want to turn to another question, and that is, you make an argument in your brief that because Prime, which is located in Eagan, Minnesota, is a third party, that jurisdiction over appellants is less favored. Can you cite any case law that supports that proposition? Because I'm very familiar with this area of law, and I didn't see anything. And it's possible I may have missed something, but is there any case law that supports that argument?
Yes, I think the cases we cite in our papers are the Bristol-Myers Squibb case out of the United States Supreme Court, as well as the Jacobs Trading case from the District of Minnesota, and the Real Properties case from the Minnesota Supreme Court.
Well, let's start with the Bristol-Myers. I'm intimately familiar with that because, as you know, we issued an opinion in the Ford Vandermeer case, which was affirmed by the Supreme Court, Minnesota Supreme Court, and then affirmed by the U.S. Supreme Court. And in that opinion, which I authored, we interpreted the Bristol-Myers case. So where in Bristol-Myers does it say that if a third party is involved, then a jurisdiction over appellants is less favored? I'm looking for that specific cite and statement by the Supreme Court.
Well, I think it's perhaps I would suggest that the contacts need to be scrutinized more closely when they are with a third party, rather than, you know, the context being directly with the plaintiff. I would suggest that that's the purpose of, or the rationale we are looking at from Bristol-Myers Squibb here for on that issue.
And where in Bristol-Myers does it say that?
If I can have a moment to pull up the case, Your Honor, here, which I'm endeavoring to do. At Pennsite 1783, in section C, there's a discussion about the defendant's relationship with a third party, being on its own an insufficient basis for jurisdiction. And in addition, apologies, I'm not finding it here. Oh, in 1781, at Pennsite 1781 as well, there's also a discussion about the connections with a third party and the sufficiency of those to establish personal jurisdiction.
Okay, thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor. So I would like to just take a moment, let's assume there are some contacts here and that there were some claims processed in Minnesota. I do think it's important to take a brief look at how the underlying reimbursement transactions at issue come about to really understand how tangential those contacts are and attenuated to the point that they really don't establish personal jurisdiction here. So I think an illustrative example might be useful. So let's say we've got a person in El Paso, Texas, who's got health insurance through Blue Cross Blue Shield of Texas. That's an insurer operated by one of the respondents' healthcare service corporation, which is an Illinois-based company. And this person can go to his local doctor in El Paso, get a prescription, and decide to bring that prescription to an Albertsons store in El Paso. The Albertsons pharmacist in El Paso then goes and fills that prescription, and from her computer in El Paso, electronically submits a claim for reimbursement to Prime, which Healthcare Service Corporation chose to be its pharmacy benefit manager. So from there, it's Prime and Healthcare Service Corporation that determine whether Prime or a third party actually processes the claim and where it'll be processed. And let's say, for instance, for purposes of this example, that it was processed at a computer server in Eagan, Minnesota, at Prime's headquarters. So from there, the claim's approved in a matter of seconds, and the approval and reimbursement are electronically transmitted back to the Albertsons store in El Paso. Right, so if we look at the relevant contacts in that scenario, which is a common scenario given that Healthcare Service Corporation is the largest insurer here and none of defendant stores are in Minnesota, we've got a Texas resident who obtained health insurance in Texas from an Illinois-based insurer who filled a prescription at a local pharmacy in Texas. All of Albertson's conduct in this circumstance took place in Texas, and the only connection to Minnesota is that the reimbursement claim briefly passed through a computer server in Eagan, Minnesota for approval. And I think even if these contacts exist, and Judge Reyes understood, your points along in that regard, however, even if those contacts with Minnesota exist and the claims were processed there, they are minimal and attenuated to the overall situation and therefore insufficient to establish personal jurisdiction.
Counsel?
Yes.
The allegations, though, are that millions of transactions took place. So we're not talking about one or two in a few minutes or a few seconds on a single transaction. We're talking about millions of transactions that if you add those minutes up, were consistent and continuous. And if you're looking at the whole trajectory, I'm wondering if you can speak a little bit to the point that respondents make that your clients are sophisticated, large businesses who chose to enter into these contracts, and they knew that Prime was located in Minnesota. And so how does that affect our analysis of this question?
Yeah, and I think on that question, Judge Wheelock, a quick look at what the Prime contracts actually are, I think, is relevant. And the district court made that point as well, in addition to respondents. You know, these are contracts between a large national retailers that operate 2,200 stores in 34 states across the country, none of which are in Minnesota, and Prime, which is a large pharmacy benefit manager that serves 30 million customers, most of which are not in Minnesota. Right. And so the contract, although Prime happens to be headquartered in Minnesota, the focus of the commercial activity under the contract is entirely taking place outside of Minnesota. It's similar to the Frieden Brothers case cited in our papers from the District of Minnesota, where even though the defendant contracted with a company it knew was headquartered in Minnesota, all of the commercial activity in that case, I think it was sales of cattle in that instance, took place out of the state. And so even though the plaintiff decided to store records and administer the contracts in Minnesota, similar to how Prime, as alleged, you know, was operating out of the headquarters in Minnesota, that was insufficient.
The commercial activity isn't just the sale. It's also the reimbursement process. Isn't that part of their commercial activity? Wouldn't it necessarily have to be in order for them to get paid?
Yes, but all of the commercial activity generates from outside of Minnesota. And again, the reimbursements are one piece of that. But we're dealing with transactions and insurers that are primarily based outside of the state of Minnesota.
Judge Klebhacke, do you have a question?
No, I had a question, but you already just asked the question. Thank you.
Understood. Thank you.
I actually have a question, Mr. Roberts, and I want to turn to you argue that the contacts from HCSC are insufficient because HCSC is even more tenuous because it's outside of Minnesota. But when we're doing the analysis, the five-factor test, and we're looking at the contacts, we focus on the appellant's contacts with the forum, not respondent's contacts. So why does it matter where they're incorporated when the focus is on what appellant's contacts are with Minnesota?
It matters in this instance, Your Honor, because HCSC operates health insurance plans entirely outside of Minnesota. The other two plaintiffs at issue operate health plans and therefore would have customers based in Minnesota. And at least theoretically, there could be some Minnesota residents engaging in those transactions, even though they all take place entirely outside of the state. Whereas with Healthcare Service Corporation, all of their insureds are outside of Minnesota, making the contacts even further attenuated with the state.
Thank you, Mr. Roberts. Your time has elapsed, and we will turn to counsel for respondent. When you are ready, you may begin.
Thank you, Your Honors. My name is Kelly Hibbert from Kroll & Mooring on behalf of Healthcare Services Corporation, as well as BCBSM Inc. And HMO Minnesota, all of the acronyms. Thank you for allowing us to present to you this morning. May it please the court. The issue of personal jurisdiction currently before your honors is a simple one and falls in line with the wealth of jurisprudence preceding this case, a lot of which you've already referred to in appellant's argument. You've actually hit a few of my counter arguments in your questions. And one of the things I did want to point out in appellant's argument, although they talk about a lot of different things in their arguments, only in response to a recent question are they talking about really the core of these contacts, which is the claims submissions and the reimbursement that all take place through Prime in Minnesota. They talked about a lot of other things, but frankly, actions speak louder than words. And we cannot and should not ignore the enormous amount of transactions appellants directed every day to Minnesota through their commercial relationship with Prime. Prime as a PBM does more than just route electronic claims. It's not as simple as appellants counsel presented it. The PBM adjudicates each claim by taking the information submitted by the pharmacy, including multiple levels of drug pricing information, and then determines whether that drug is covered under the specific member's health plan benefit, and then determines what price the health plan must pay the pharmacy for that drug. All of that takes place at the PBM's location in Minnesota in this case. The only PBM intermediary involved in all of the claims at issue in this case is Prime, which is located in Eagan, Minnesota. That fact was pled in our complaint, and appellants have offered no evidence that any transaction at issue in this case occurred outside of Minnesota. I heard for the first time this morning about offices that Prime may or may not have outside of Minnesota. That fact is not reflected in the allegations in the complaint, nor is that reflected in any of that evidence that is on record to date. Yes, Your Honor.
It would be helpful, I think, if you could actually identify the paragraphs in the complaint where the plaintiff's respondents allege that transactions did in fact occur in Minnesota.
Yes. In the complaint, we allege at paragraph 14 that Prime is located in Eagan, Minnesota. And in throughout the complaint, I'm going to try to find you the specific pin sites right now. We specifically submit paragraph 37 that during the relevant time period, payments on all claims under these plans to defendants were made through a single PBM, Prime. And the claims processing process is outlined in paragraph 38, subsections A through D, and that specifically details the flow of information from the pharmacies to Prime, and then to the plans, and then the reimbursements from the plans to Prime to the pharmacies. It should be inferred, because respondents have alleged clearly that Prime is the only PBM at issue in the case and is located in Eagan, Minnesota, without any evidence of any other actions by Prime outside of Minnesota, that all of the transactions that are detailed in the complaint specifically took place in Minnesota. And respondents have alleged that Prime adjudicated every claim at issue in this case for Safeway that amounts to more than 9 million claims and resulted in $445 million of reimbursement. For Albertsons, it's 14 million claims worth more than $786 million. And these claims are at the heart of respondents' fraud case against appellants, because it is through these claims for reimbursement that appellants perpetrated their fraud, with Minnesota being ground zero.
Is there less of a connection, both in terms of the nature and quality of the contacts with the Illinois party?
Respectfully, no, Your Honor. I think there was a question earlier in appellant's case about, you know, why the fact that the plaintiff HCSE is incorporated outside of Minnesota, how that would impact the analysis of personal jurisdiction. And it doesn't. Personal jurisdiction, you look at the defendant, in this case, the appellant's contacts with the state. All of the claims at issue for HCSE in this case still went through Prime in Minnesota. And those contacts between the appellants and Minnesota are what form the basis of personal jurisdiction in this case, regardless of where the plaintiff exists. And frankly, I just want to address one quick point, too, that Judge Reyes noted with regard to the Bristol-Myers Squibb case. Respectfully, appellants are wrong about that issue. The fact that a third party is involved in the minimum contacts analysis doesn't negate in any way the sufficiency of the contacts. BMS and its progeny stands for the very specific point that the claims must be tied to that third party's existence, those contacts with the third parties, in order for the minimum contacts through those third parties to be sufficient for personal jurisdiction.
Ms. Hibbert, I want to turn to a more general issue, and that is actually, it sounds like your arguments are going toward more specific personal jurisdiction versus general jurisdiction. It seems that the general jurisdiction arguments, to be candid, are tenuous at best. Are you focusing more on specific personal jurisdiction then?
Frankly, I think we're addressing both general jurisdiction and specific jurisdiction through our argument. The bottom line is that appellant's contacts were continuous and systematic, but they also are tied, they're related to and arose out of appellant, I'm sorry, the claims are tied to or arose out of appellant's contacts. Either way, jurisdiction is met. And if respondents haven't submitted the type of evidence that would negate a finding of continuous and systematic contacts with Minnesota. Specifically, they don't dispute that they submitted the millions of claims transactions to Prime in Minnesota over the course of at least 8 years with specific evidence. And that's different than cases cited by appellants like the NextGen case, where the District of Minnesota held personal jurisdiction was not satisfied after jurisdictional discovery was conducted, and evidence revealed that only 5% of plaintiffs' annual revenue came from Minnesota contacts. No such evidence was presented here, and no jurisdictional discovery, of course, was conducted. As the record stands, continuous and systematic contacts with Minnesota is evidenced by the contacts with Prime in Minnesota. We think that that justifies both general and specific jurisdiction because those contacts are tied to the claims at issue in the case. We are also pursuing the argument of consent jurisdiction against Safeway. And we've argued for application of consent jurisdiction over Safeway because they registered an agent for service of process in Minnesota. Frankly, we were delayed in raising this argument due to appellant's own misrepresentations in their submitted affidavit of Daniel Salimi, which asserted that Safeway had not authorized anyone to accept service on its behalf in Minnesota. That turns out not to be true at all, and Safeway has consented to jurisdiction in Minnesota. That's a well-accepted concept in Minnesota, and this court reviewing the issue of personal jurisdiction de novo is not restricted in reviewing matters as the interest of justice requires. We submit to you today that the interests of justice do require your honors to consider consent jurisdiction as to Safeway because it's decisive of the issue of personal jurisdiction as to Safeway. It was raised prominently in our brief and is closely akin to the arguments presented in the district court. Therefore, it's appropriate for the court to decide at this time.
Ms. Hibbert, could you please briefly address the Schaefer case? I understand that's a non-precedential opinion, but it's a recent one from our court just 6 years ago. And in that one, we applied the Walker case, which is 1989 Court of Appeals decision and the rationale of that. And that seems to be a fairly similar case in the fact that the contract contained a Minnesota choice of law provision, which is one of the allegations I think that you make in terms of the contacts. Minnesota LLC's case in that case was the sole member was also a Minnesota resident and testified to doing 80% of the work for that appellant in Minnesota. But that seems to be fairly persuasive. Why shouldn't we follow that decision interpreting Walker?
Yeah, it's a good question, Your Honor. In that case, the plaintiff was arguing personal jurisdiction based on the defendant's contract with the plaintiff in which the plaintiff provided services in Minnesota. But there was evidence that the contracts were negotiated and signed in California. There's no evidence that the contracts were negotiated and signed anywhere other than Minnesota at this point. And frankly, with regard to the contract with Albertsons, which was previously negotiated, originally negotiated with another defendant, SuperValue, which is a Minnesota company, there's an inference that that contract was actually negotiated and signed in Minnesota. So different here than in the Schaefer case. Also different, the work that the plaintiff performed for the defendant in Schaefer was implemented in California. That's different here. Ann Schaefer, the only contact with the Minnesota plaintiff was outside of Minnesota. It's different here because all of the contacts at issue that underpin our case were with Prime in Minnesota. So you'd have to almost change the facts in our case to appellant's contacts with Prime occurring outside of Minnesota for it to be in line with Schaefer, but that's not what has been alleged in the case. A couple of other points I wanted to hit before my time is up. You mentioned, Judge Reyes, the choice of law provision, and I did want to note one thing about that. That's contained in the Albertsons Prime Agreement in Section 9.9, and appellants argue that the choice of law provision in the Prime Agreement is insufficient to establish personal jurisdiction, and they cite SmartCart versus Vantran, an opinion out of this court. This case is easily distinguished. SmartCart involved an employment contract, and this court weighed heavily the fact that the contract was not negotiated. Here, the choice of law provision is within a contract between two sophisticated commercial entities, not an employee and an employer. The contacts at issue in SmartCart only included 2 to 3 meetings in Minnesota over the course of 20 years. Compare that here to the millions of claims transactions over the course of at least 8 years, and the difference is clear on that point. Your Honors, appellants also point to cases such as Walden to argue that appellants' contacts with Prime were merely directed at a resident of the state of Minnesota, not the state itself. But in Walden and its progeny, courts have defined random, fortuitous, and attenuated contracts to specifically carve out a defendant's contacts with the forum state that are intertwined with its transactions or interactions with plaintiffs or other parties. That's the situation here. It's the same as it was in the Riley case, where the millions of commercial transactions here with Prime were not random. Rather, they constitute intertwined contacts with both a Minnesota company and the state of Minnesota. As in Riley, which the court found that 1,000 emails directed towards Minnesota residents satisfied was sufficient to establish personal jurisdiction, the millions of commercial transactions directed towards Minnesota to Prime in Minnesota in this case are sufficient to establish personal jurisdiction. And we can also contrast this with the Young case. There, the court assessed only 3 contacts in Minnesota, 1 email, and 2 online postings. This court distinguished those contacts with the thousands of emails to Minnesota residents that supported personal jurisdiction in Riley, and also noted that in Young, the contacts did not seek to engage in a business relationship, which differed in Riley and here, where appellant's contracts all involve their business relationship with Prime. I also wanted to note for the court that appellant's own third-party complaint against Prime Therapeutics, which has been filed, supports respondents' arguments. In the third-party complaint against Prime, appellants state that Prime adjudicates the claims submitted by the pharmacies, transmits payments to the pharmacies based on the agreements with the pharmacies, and submits its own claims to the plans pursuant to the Prime plan contracts and receives payment from the plans. You know what's missing from that third-party complaint? Any allegations that any of that conduct took place outside of Minnesota. And that is, I submit to your honors, because that evidence does not exist. Thank you for the time. I see my time is up.
Thank you, Ms. Ebert. We will turn to counsel for the appellants for the last word. Please begin when you're ready, Mr. Roberts.
Thank you, Judge Wheelock. A couple of brief points in response. On general jurisdiction, I think the district court and Ms. Hibbert both focus on the continuous and systematic contacts element of the general personal jurisdiction analysis, but they both ignore the part of the analysis that requires those contacts to render a corporation essentially at home in the forum. Again, these are companies that are not headquartered in Minnesota, have no principal place of business in Minnesota, and no exceptional circumstances such as those presented in the BNSF Railway case where 2,000 miles of railroad tracks and 2,000 employees in the forum were insufficient to create exceptional circumstances. There's nothing that rises to that level here. So I would submit general personal jurisdiction does not apply. With respect to the burden issue, I just want to focus again on the fact that the evidence and that we submitted under the Riley case does then go ahead and submit the, shift the burden to the respondents to establish minimum contacts here. I think a lot of the focus and the argument is on what we did or did not prove, but the burden is on them to establish jurisdiction, not on us to disprove, you know, things that are can maybe inferred from that. And along those lines, in their brief, respondents, you know, talk about, you know, the prime contracts being, quote, but one piece of the puzzle for jurisdiction here. And Ms. Hibbert referred to where contracts were negotiated. There's nothing in the record on that issue as to where any contracts were negotiated, whether anybody traveled to Minnesota for negotiating or administering the contracts. The record is simply silent on that. And again, it would be a respondent's burden to put that up. On the consent jurisdiction point, I think, you know, that argument is plainly waived. It was not raised in the court below. And as we set forth in our papers and given the shortness of time, we'll rely on the papers, but just want to reiterate the point of this being an unsettled question of constitutional law, and that the general jurisdiction cases from the United States Supreme Court that are, you know, at issue in the case currently pending before the court were all later decided than the most recent Minnesota Supreme Court precedent on the consent jurisdiction issue. And so we would submit, as the majority of state courts that have addressed this issue have, that the more recent general jurisdiction analysis from the United States Supreme Court overrides the consent jurisdiction statute to the extent the court finds the need to address the question, which we submit it should not because of the waiver issue. I do want to talk briefly as well about the Walker Management case that I believe Judge Reyes asked about. And I do think that that case is, you know, really on point here. You know, as was the case here, you have a contract out of by, you know, with a Minnesota resident for purposes of administering business entirely outside of Minnesota. And, you know, even though the work was done by plaintiffs in the Walker Management case in Minnesota, the fact that the nexus of the contract at issue was commercial activity entirely outside of Minnesota was sufficient for this court to reverse the district court's order denying a motion to dismiss on the lack of personal jurisdiction.
Mr. Roberts, yes. Mr. Roberts, could you briefly address the Rite Aid case that was cited by the district court here? And that's, well, it's persuasive authority because it's from the District of Minnesota. It has strikingly similar facts, including claims involving Prime as the PBM and allegations of a fraudulent UNC overcharge scheme. So, you know, that seems fairly persuasive. And you had you know, very similar situation. Why isn't that persuasive authority that we should follow?
Judge Reyes, you read my mind as to where I was going to close, actually. So in Rite Aid, two key factors distinguishing the Rite Aid case from this situation. First, there was no jurisdictional evidence submitted by either party. And the court actually specifically noted that point in its opinion, that neither party had introduced any evidence and specifically noted the contracts as well were not before the court. And for the reasons I've stated before, our view is that the evidence we've submitted, you know, minimizes any contacts and shows that any contacts that Albertsons and Safeway had with Minnesota were quite attenuated. The second distinguishing factor is the impact of Calder v. Jones and the Calder effects test. Neither party addressed that in Rite Aid. We addressed the Calder effects test extensively in our brief. And given the nationwide conduct at issue here, none of the conduct alleged was performed for the purposes of having consequences felt in Minnesota. And that's the test under the Johnson v. Arden case from the Eighth Circuit, applying Calder in the Eighth Circuit. So for those two reasons, I would suggest Rite Aid should be distinguished.
Judge Wheelock, if I may ask one final question.
Yes.
Thank you. Mr. Roberts, actually, we didn't really get a chance to talk about the Calder effects test, and there's really a dearth of case law on the Calder facts, but there's at least one case that seems to indicate that that really is just one more factor, and it's not so much, it's not something that really overrides the five-factor personal jurisdiction test. Don't we really ultimately need to apply the five-factor test?
Yes, Your Honor, and I agree with you. I think the Calder effects test is an alternative path to specific personal jurisdiction, where the contacts can be established with the forum rather than necessarily, you know, the plaintiff or the suit-related contact. If the effects under Calder are tied to the forum itself, that can be sufficient to establish minimum contacts under, you know, a version of the traditional specific personal jurisdiction test. So that's how I read how Calder and the traditional test interact. And I think given that these are intentional torts and there are allegations that there was conduct directed into Minnesota, I think that's why the Rite Aid court mentioned Calder and suggested that it might be relevant here, where you have an intentional tort conduct, intentional tort claims where conduct is alleged to have been targeted into Minnesota. The parties didn't address how or if at all Calder affected the analysis there. And I think our papers do so here.
Thank you, Mr. Roberts.
Thank you, Judge Reyes. And thank you all, Your Honors.
Any other questions from the panel? No? Okay. Well, thank you very much.